Hello, my name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela. And this is Wicks and Candles, a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period film.
We want to dig into our favorite films and review them. Understand why we love them. How they shaped us. What effect do they have on us?
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wicks and candles.
In this episode, A Room with a View.
The first movie we want to talk about is A Room with a View. We chose this movie because it really encapsulates everything that we love about period films. Even though we were really young when this movie came out, we were immediately fascinated by the beauty of it and the romance of the story. Before we start discussing Nene, can you give us some facts about the movie?
Yes, I would love to. And just a little warning. If you haven't seen this movie, there will be spoilers. A Room with a View is a 1985 British film based on the novel A Room with a View by E.M. Foster. The film was directed by James Ivory. He's one half of the famous Merchant Ivory production team who went on to produce other beloved period films such as Howard's End, and Remains of a Day. The movie was very successful right after it came out. It was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, and it won 3, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Art Direction, and Best Costume Design. It also won 5 British Academy Film Awards, or BAFTAs, Best Film, Best Leading Actress, Best Supporting Actress, Best Production Design, and Best Costume Design. So, Gabby, can you tell us a bit about the story of the movie?
Yeah, sure. The film tells the story of Lucy Honeychurch, who's played by Helena Bonham Carter, who's a young English woman on a trip to Florence with her cousin Charlotte Bartlett, played by Maggie Smith. While being there, they meet other English travelers, including Mr. Emerson and his son, George, played by Julian Sands. This meeting turns out to be a fateful one, and her plans to get engaged back in England become really complicated.
The first time we watched this movie was when it first came out. But I'm sure I watched it at least a couple times over the years, but I don't remember exactly when. Of course, I watched it again recently in preparation for this podcast. And one thing that I had forgotten about was how funny this movie was. So, Gabby, what were your first impressions of the movie?
Well, we were really young, so I guess I was fascinated by the looks of the film, the entire atmosphere, this warmth that it's really radiates with the landscapes and the entire light of the scenery, and of course this kind of carefree tone of the entire story was certainly something that captivated me back then. And you are right, the humor of the film is something that really makes it special in a way that is not just like a costume drama, but the entire story is told in a very humorous way. And yeah, I those were my first impressions, and now that I've seen it now, that's what kind of makes it gave me the confirmation why I find it so special. So how about you? Now that you have seen this movie again, so many years afterwards, what is your impression today? I'm pretty sure that Back then, when we were really young, you saw it with other eyes as when you see it now as a grown-up woman.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I could say that if I go back to when we would have watched this movie, we were very little. I would have been 10 or 11. You would have been 7 or 8. So I'm sure we watched it a couple years after it came out. Movies usually take a little while in Venezuela to be shown in theaters. So I'm sure we either watched it right in 1985 or, you know, a couple years after, when we could have a little bit more understanding of what the movie was about. But back then, I was definitely struck by, you know, the period costume, the recreation of the period, how beautiful it was, you know, all the aesthetic details were really spectacular for me, and something that I started realizing I love from a very young age. Now that I watched it again, like I said earlier, I was struck by the humor. I had forgotten very much how funny this movie is. In my memory, it was much more a stuffy English movie. And I had completely forgotten how funny it was. And I think one thing that impacted that, I think, is because back then we didn't speak English. We didn't understand. So we would have seen the movie with subtitles, and we were, of course, very young. And nowadays we understand much more. So I think we can understand the nuances and the language. So I think that's the impression I have today.
That's a really good point. I guess I absolutely agree with you on that. And you're right. Back then, we were, of course, very susceptible to the images, yeah, to the aesthetics. And as I mentioned before, this is something that impressed me back then. And now that I've seen it today, impressed me again. The colors, the landscapes of the film, and of course, the setting. Yeah, this wonderful, warm landscapes, and then you see all this nice English society people with white dresses in a beautiful meadow. I think those pictures just really left an impression on me back then, and I still enjoyed it so much to see it again. It radiates such a warmth and such a light, and also because of this humorous way, it's still a light story to see and to watch and to enjoy.
Yeah. The one thing we have to mention is that the movie takes place both in Florence and in England, just before the First World War. So there is throughout, and this is something that we understand now, and we didn't quite understand when we watched it for the first time. There's a particular period in history that's being portrayed here, which is the period just before the war. And I think, and when we were talking in preparation for the podcast, we believed, you know, that's what gives it such a carefree spirit to the whole movie and to the whole story. They could not have possibly known what was coming. So, and also the movie happens, you know, in summer. So we see, you know, both Florence and England in the summer. It's sunny, it's beautiful, it's warm. Summer dresses, summer gardens. It's just, you know, it's the opportunity for such beauty to be presented in film.
Totally, not a drop of rain. Well, there is one day when it rains.
I think there is some rain, but
there is some rain. But it's a summer storm. So
it's a summer. A sexy summer storm.
Correct.
So, Gabby, should we talk about the cast a little bit?
Sure. So we're seeing some of today's most established English actors and actresses. Helena Bonham Carter was back then very young, and this was one of her first appearances on screen. And this certainly marked a milestone in her career, because this certainly gave the path forward for her acting career. We see a very motivating and sparkling Maggie Smith as her cousin.
Yeah.
As chaperone. Wonderful. We see Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays the role of Cecil Vice, who will be the fiancé of Lucy Honeychurch during the film. And he is very refreshing in this role because, apart from being very young, he is playing someone with humor. And Daniel Day-Lewis' career is full of, very demanding roles afterwards. So this was this was very refreshing to see him playing such a humorous role.
That's right.
Yeah. So as you can hear from there, we have a full cast of really the best of the best of the English acting scene. But of course, the beginning in 1985, these were names that were being on the making. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were on the making. And one cast is, which we will certainly drop a line or two about, is Julian Sands as George Emerson. So the love counterpart for Lucy Honeychurch, who is a little bit edgy as an actor, but I think gives him exactly the right touch for the role of George.
Yeah. Can we actually discuss this? Because now that we're talking about the cast, you know, I think for us as very young girls, one huge piece of the magic, one huge part of why we were so in love with this movie when we were little, and why we remember it so fondly as grown-ups, definitely had to be Helena Bonham Carter's performance and you know, her whole appearance. She is playing an Edwardian, the most classic Edwardian young lady, and she seems sort of perfectly made for this period, with her, you know, long hair and her heart-shaped face, and she is so. We have grown seeing her in so many other movies, a lot of period films, but also the Harry Potter films and so many other more quirky roles. And then to go back and see her playing a very young, innocent, fresh, young woman is so fun. It is truly wonderful. And for then and now, I find her performance really wonderful, because she's it's hard to pinpoint. She's a very good-hearted young woman. She seems to be very much made for following the rules. And Helena Bonham Carter, she has this quirky streak, right? She's not the most conventional, and she brings this little touch of kind of rebellious freedom underneath her performance. And but then you also mentioned Julian Sands, and I have to admit that watching the movie again, I wasn't exactly sure why he was cast as George. He seemed to me so just a little bit weird. I mean, he never he's the romantic. He's a romantic figure. He's a romantic lead, but he's very a bit too playful. I still not 100% sure if I buy him as George.
Okay, because it's interesting because when we now re-see the film, we have both the feeling Helena Bonham Carter is absolutely the perfect cast for playing the role of Lucy Honeychurch, who has this dilemma, yeah, of being the well-educated society woman, but who's struggling to find her space and to live out her passions, yeah?
Yeah.
So she is absolutely 100% perfectly played by Helena Bonham Carter, exactly this dilemma. Now, regarding Julian Sands and his role as George Emerson, in my eyes, this is where we disagree, I think he is perfectly played by Julian Sands, because exactly this contradiction in him, and it's exactly this not exactly fitting the pattern of a regular society boy in England, is exactly what he as an actor brings into the role. So I think Julian Sands is exactly right. He wasn't conventional. George Emerson wasn't a conventional man. He was also struggling to find his space in society and also struggling to leave his freedom and his passion. Yeah.
Yeah.
When we talk maybe about our favorite scenes, we will mention a few things about his motivations. and exactly this edginess is brought in by Julian Sands' performance. So in my eyes, he is perfect for the role.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. It's true, and we haven't given much context to what we're talking about. The thing is, yes, this is 1913 England, and this is, you know, full on Edwardian society where the roles and expectations of, you know, men and women were very, very clearly defined and, you know, expected to be followed. So we have Lucy Honeychurch, who's a middle class, you know, well-to-do girl, but not as well-to-do as the family would hope to be, a marriage age. So she has to put all her effort into behaving in a way that will be conductive to finding a husband that will elevate her position in society. And when she goes on this trip to Florence with her chaperone, this is the opportunity to experience life a little bit, to experience life outside of this, you know, constant search for the perfect husband. This trip to Florence is expected to be some part of her education in art, in language, in culture overall. And for George, he's also a middle class, but lower middle class young man. The burden on him is not as heavy as on Lucy, but still, like you said, it's quite heavy as well. He has to find a profession, find a wife, support her. He has to fulfill a number of roles. And both of them, as we learn later, are quite unconventional. So they're both kind of fighting against the expectations. And each of them do it in a different way. Lucy does it in a very subtle way, where George does it in a more open, eccentric way.
A stormy way. Yes, we see a scene while they're in Florence, in this small hotel where they're staying at. We see a scene of Lucy playing the piano.
Yeah.
And she plays a very passionate Beethoven piece. And she is being watched by a reverend who also plays a minor role in the story, but he's also watching Lucy Honeychurch playing the piano, and he is impressed by the passion and by the strength that she is conveying through her piano playing. So that's her way of expressing what's in it, what's in it for her. Yeah, kind of to let it all out through music. Yeah.
And doesn't he ask her, shoot, you know, doesn't he ask her, should you actually be playing Beethoven? Is this appropriate?
Is this appropriate, yeah, for such a young lady to play in such passionate pieces? Yeah, so that's just how you mentioned it. She's trying to express that in a more subtle way. Yeah. While George is a more free-spirited person. Yeah. And there is a beautiful scene where this group of English travelers who are staying at this hotel, well, they go out for a road trip and they make a picnic. And they're sitting on a meadow. The women are sitting separate from the men. And you as a viewer see George climbing on a tree. And letting some of his feelings out while being out there. So maybe you want to say a word or two about that scene, Nene?
Yes, I can, you know, that's one of the most important scenes in the whole movie, because during this picnic, something quite important happens. So yeah, George, the two groups separate, the women are sitting in one meadow, the men are sitting in another, and George climbed this tree, and is not the strongest of trees, it's sort of like a wobbly tree. Yeah, it's sort of like a wobbly tree, and he starts screaming to the world a few things. He starts screaming, freedom, love, passion, and he's just screaming on top of this wobbly tree until, what happens, Gabby?
Until a branch breaks and he falls off a tree. So here exactly this, we can see how George is trying to express his feeling and how he copes with this dilemma, yeah, of, you know, trying to fit the mold, but actually wanting something else. Yeah, so.
Yeah. You know, this scene, Gabby, is so important because I think this scene, but it resonates today, but it surely resonated when we were young. Even though we didn't really understand it, I think it resonated anyway, because as we have discussed before, when we both were very young, we would sit, you know, at our window in our apartment. And, you know, that's something that we did. We were two girls who really wanted to see the world. We were really trying to find out what was out there in the world. And we felt really confined by Venezuelan society, even as young girls. And I remember we would sit at the window and we would scream, quiero vivir, I want to live. So this, you know, the fact that George is going into the wobbly tree and screaming these things in the air in Florence is very much, you know, I can totally relate. And I think this is a great and funny scene.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is why this is maybe one of the elements that makes this film so special for us, because we can relate so much. We could relate back then already so much with the characters. Yeah, these struggles.
Yeah, the struggles.
Wanting more and being confined somehow.
Exactly. Despite, you know, the beautiful look and the beautiful costumes, and, you know, for Lucy to be dressed in these wonderful costumes and these dresses, and she was sort of like everything I wanted to be at 13 or 14. You know, I wanted to play piano like that. I wanted to look like that. I wanted to, you know, it was such a romantic image for me. The fact that she was, you know, yearning for more, and she could only express it through the piano. Everything yeah. about her, I could dream of being.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can see very clearly that they are both very much struggling to fit in. Not so much to fit in, but to find who they are and how to express that in a way that is appropriate, appropriate to the expectations of their roles in English society at the time.
Totally. Absolutely. After he falls the tree, there's something that's happening again, and which is maybe one of my favorite scenes of the entire film, if I may mention so. So he falls off the tree, and Lucy looks for them because she gets a little bit bored of sitting with the ladies. So she starts looking for the men, and she finds George standing in the middle of a meadow. And she walks a little bit clumsy, a little bit insecure. She walks a little bit towards him, and he notices her presence and turns around and walks towards her, but with very determined big steps, and gives her a very, very romantic kiss. So for me, this image of these two young people standing in this meadow, very sunny, warm Italian meadow, her dress white against the yellow of the grass, and George with his hat just dropping it on the floor. I think this is really one of the most special scenes in the film for me, and maybe also from many comparing to many other key scenes in many other films, one of my favorites of all time.
Yeah, and with reason. I think that's the most classic scene in the whole movie, and I think it's sort of like the key image of the film. It's this couple kissing in this meadow, and you know. It is the key moment of the movie, and what will cause all the ensuing complications for each of their lives. Absolutely, it's a great scene. And then I remember when we were little, we would have watched this, and I have to admit I didn't understand the movie before. Obviously, I was too young. And I would not have understood the emotions of the characters at that time, their motivations. Today I do. Obviously, I'm an adult. I think it just serves to show their spontaneous nature, which again goes in, is in contrast to what was expected of them. And it is a beautiful done scene, gorgeous. And I think there's a lot to say about the production design of the movie. The fact that it has endured in our minds for so long, I think is a testament of how beautiful the costumes and how beautiful the locations and how beautiful the set designs were. And especially this scene is a total classic scene for period films.
Absolutely, Nene. So maybe this is a good transition to our next topic, the production of the film. As you mentioned, this key scene really portrays how much how well the production team managed to capture this atmosphere of the time, of the location, of the surrounding, and of the two characters. One scene, it transports so much. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, and maybe also the costume design, which we have mentioned already was award-winning.
Yes, so it was a team made by Ginny Beaven and John Bride. And like we said at the top, they won the Oscar for best costume. And I think one of the obviously, one of the main attractions of period films is costume and production design, because what it does is it takes you to the period. This is what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to place you in a time and space, specific time and space, and is supposed to support the story because, you know, the characters are influenced by their time, and the costumes and the dress of the time. So this movie, even how many years after, almost 40 years after it was made, I think it's impeccable. The costumes in this movie are impeccable. And we're going to say right now, we are not costume historians or costume experts. We just watched a lot of period films. So I'm just going to put that there. But in my eyes, the costumes in this movie are perfection. I think they're true to period. They're a dream to see, because like we said, it happens in the summer, so there's a lot of white, tan colors. There's a lot of light linens, and it is an absolute so beautiful dream for me. Obviously the Hollywood and the British Academy thought the same, because they were an award winning team, Jeannie Beebe and John Bright, absolutely
wonderful. And I think one of the things that makes it so amazing, or what is most impressing about this, is that, as you mentioned, this film is so old, and even if you watch it today, it looks timeless. So you don't see any influences of the time of the production in the production. So that happens with some films that you say, okay, this film was made in the 70s, and you see the touch of the production, the lights, the costume. You see, okay, it has been made in the 70s. But when you see this film, you are completely in the time, and you can't really tell. Yes. This film was made in the 80s. And I think that's pretty much the biggest achievement from the production team, as well, of course, from the costume design team, that they really managed to make this film timeless. It tells the story of those times, and it's not telling a story of a film being made in the 80s.
I love that.
Absolutely. And I think this is also maybe, when you say the entire production in combination with the costume design, it is a perfect constellation. The entire combination, the entire production, the setting, the locations, and the costume design, and the cast, it makes it really a jewel of a period film. Because it makes it absolutely round. It's like a circle.
Yeah.
It's a circle. There is really no flaw in between. And this is maybe also what makes the Merchant Ivory production so special, because they have created really stunning films exactly in this combination, where they put so much value and so much detail on the production, on the costume design, that makes it really special and timeless.
Yeah, you are so right about that. True, you can tell that it's a film from the 80s. Like I said, it looks really true to period. And not only that, but the script is really well done. I listened to the audiobook of the novel, and it's really true to the novel as well. It kept the humor. There's a lot of witty conversations. It just shows a very specific period of time, like I said, before the war, which makes it even more poignant. You know that this kind of carefree period is going to end very soon, and a lot of the men in this movie will most likely be going to war and die. So it makes it a little bit more poignant as well in terms of the story. It happens just 1 year before the war starts.
Yes. And I think that's also part of the magic of the story, of course, as you mentioned, because it portrays a little piece of a moment, a snapshot in history that is loaded with this carefreeness. Yeah.
Before we move on to the final topic, can we talk about Daniel Day-Lewis a little bit more? I know that you said that he was kind of playing against character for what we know of him now.
Exactly. We are biased now by what we know today of Daniel Day-Lewis. But of course, back then, maybe he was relatively unknown for us as young viewers anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, he plays the character of Cecil Weiss, who is the fiancé of Lucy Honeychurch and who is pretty much the opposite of her, who is very stiff and absolutely convinced than being proper stiff and well-educated is absolutely the best you can do and the only right thing to do. While Lucy Honeychurch does like to break the mold from time to time. So Cecil is always very well-dressed. He does not lose glamour at any point, even though he might be outside or might be hot or they might be relaxed on the park. He would never lose his glamour, while Lucy, on the contrary, wouldn't really care. Even though she's a lady in a big white fancy dress, she wouldn't mind to sit on the grass, for example. So those are that's like kind of the contrast of the character of Cecil compared to Lucy Honeychurch. And this character being played by Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, the kind of actor who afterwards was everything but conventional and everything but stiff and yeah, everything but glamorous. Daniel Day-Lewis is today acknowledged for all the non-conventional roles that he has chosen to play. And that makes it for us today as viewers really refreshing to see how well he could still perform such a kind of clumsy, silly, stiff role. Yeah. And that's maybe also the beauty of Daniel Day-Lewis there, because you can see how many different sides he as an actor can show.
That's right.
What do you say to that?
That's right. Yeah, no, I agree. He was not afraid to be funny, to be silly. He plays with a lot of humor. He really enjoys playing that character. And like you said, he's not only but he's the opposite of Lucy, but not only the opposite of Lucy, he's the opposite of George Emerson.
Totally.
We realize, you know, George is he's very physical, he's sort of muscular, sporty, he plays tennis, he runs around like a young boy. His style of dress is quite different as well. It's much more relaxed, much more sport style of suits. Whereas Cecil is, you know, always dressed. He's a dandy, essentially. He's a dandy, including the monocle. What a brilliant piece of casting, and what a brilliant pleasure to go and see Daniel Day-Lewis in this movie in 1985. It's just, I think it's one of my favorite things of the whole movie. It is just delicious. And they are, you know, and they're essentially playing two opposite extremes of a male expectations, I guess, in the period. And Lucy is in the middle, having to choose between the two.
Absolutely. Between the free-spirited, I don't really care how my suit looks like, George, or the I know what exactly is right, and I don't even dare to take off my shoes in society, Cecil.
That's right. Yeah, but the thing for Lucy is she has to, you know, because of her position, like we said, she's a middle class, upper middle class, but she still would need a good marriage to kind of have a good position in society. So it is kind of essential for her family to marry her to Cecil. But of course, you know, after her experience in Florence, that is not exactly what happens. Gabby, but why don't we talk quickly, really quickly about a scene that shows how different these two male characters are. So by a stroke of luck, George Emerson and his dad end up moving to the same town as Lucy. She had thought that she would never see him again after that kiss, but you know, now he's there living in her same town. And the same day that he moves there, Lucy's brother goes to visit him, unknowing, he doesn't know what the history between his sister and George, and he invites him to swim in a pond. And at that same scene, we see the reverend, who's also visiting, and the two young men and the reverend, who's a middle-aged man, go to the pond to take a swim. And what happens, Gabby?
My gosh, this is also one of my favorite scenes in the movie. So it's a hot summer day in countryside England. And as you mentioned, the Reverend George and Lucy's brother, Freddie, go for a swim. And they take off all the clothes and jump into water. So being silly and playing in the water because they're in such a good mood, in this summer atmosphere, they start running around the pond being completely naked. Funnily enough, at the same time, Lucy and her mom and Cecil decide to go for a stroll. And since this is some place apparently that they know from always, from early days, they pass by the pond. Yeah, so we see this very serious, properly dressed three characters passing by the pond and being absolutely shocked by the image of these three men running around naked around the pond. So we see two different, completely different reactions. We see Lucy just giggling. She saw George running naked around the pond. And instead of being completely shocked, she hides a giggle behind her hand. And then, of course, we see the exact opposite from Cecil, who is absolutely shocked and tries to move Lucy away from the scene so that she's not facing this horrible scene. Shocking scene.
Yeah, it's such a funny... I think that is also one of the most puzzling scenes as well for me. I think as a kid and now as a grown-up as well. I mean, it's just very interesting choice in directing and acting. Yeah, it really looks like they're just improvising, you know, they just pushing each other into the water and just playing around completely naked. But again, it's a very, very funny scene as well. It just goes to show, you know, what Lucy can have. She can have the spontaneity and the freedom and, you know, to be herself, or, you know, the title and the position, which seems quite simplistic when we put it this way, but yes, you know, there's a lot more depth. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is such a great actor. He does give much more depth to Cecil than we give him credit for here. Yeah. So the decision is not
it's not as easy, exactly.
And that's, you know, that is also a testament of how well the book is written and how well the script is written as well. Yeah, Gabby. So now that we have touched on all of these topics, and that we have watched this movie again as grown-ups, do you still love it? And if yes, why?
I do still love this film. And I would even go so far to say that it's really my all-time favorite period film, because for me, it's perfect from beginning to the end. The story, the characters, the actors, the setting, this feeling of, carefree summer. It makes, when I see it, I just feel warmth in my heart. And this is exactly what a film should have for me. It's like a certain kind of magic that I enjoy even now after so many years. So definitely I do definitely love it. And also this timeless feeling, that even though it's such an old film, that it doesn't feel old. It is, for me, it is a timeless film because maybe the production is so well done. How about you?
I agree with you. I loved this movie when I was young. I loved it when I watched it in my 20s and 30s. And I loved it when I watched it to prepare for the podcast. So I still love it. And actually, I love it more now because I understand it more. I understand the humor more. I understand the nuances more. I enjoy the actors in these early roles that they're playing. I think it's a classic movie, very well done. Like you said, timeless. It is just a joy to watch. And it tells something about the period, which for me is really important. That is not only true to period, but it's actually in big part because it's adapted from a book from the time. It does tell us something about the period. It does tell us something about what it was to be, in this case, something very specific, a middle class or upper class young lady and a middle lower class young man, and what it was to try to find fulfillment and love in in the early 20th century. So it does show me something about about the time that I crave. This is what I crave. I crave understanding about a period and how women specifically moved around and moved about and tried to fulfill their roles.
And I guess something that makes it also maybe special for us is this how relatable it is, even though it tells a story of back then, how relatable it is that we can still kind of identify with their struggle, of trying to fit, trying to make the right choice between heart and mind and being rational or emotional. That makes it, of course, very relatable, even though it's such an old story.
That's right. Yeah. Between, a position, in a good position in society, and love, essentially, and, the fear behind that decision.
So Nene, now that we have reviewed this film in detail, how many wicks and candles would you give A Room with a View?
Whoa. I'm gonna give 9.5 wicks and candles to A Room with a View. And the reason is this. I think I've been spoiled by adulthood and by living in North America. And the kissing scene, despite being one of the most beautiful, beautiful scenes in the whole movie and in a classic, I've been spoiled. I feel that that George should have asked permission. It's a very lame observation. But that's the only reason why. But otherwise, it's a perfect film, and I can watch it, and I will be watching for many years to come. What about you?
I give it a 10. And
because, as I said, for me, it fulfills everything that I would like, that I like in a period film. And there we also disagree, just as we disagree on Julian Sands. I think the kissing scene is wonderful, and it is it fits the time. It fits the time. Back then, he wouldn't have asked for permission, and in that time, she wouldn't have acted with rejection or anything. I think it does portray the proper reaction of a man and a woman in that time. So
you are so right.
So you are a little bit biased by today's standards. Absolutely.
Yeah, I accept that criticism fully, because I think moving forward for all our reviews, we really need to watch movies without taking off our modern day lenses. We have to watch them, you know, for what they are, the stories for what they are, for the period. So I take that criticism full on.
Very well.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Gabby. That was an amazing discussion about a wonderful movie, and we cannot recommend it enough. If you haven't seen A Room with a View, you can rent it from many different streaming services, and I highly recommend it.
The same from me.
Okay, well, that's the episode. Thank you so much for listening.
And join us next time.
Yeah, see you soon.
Wicks and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Wicks and Candles. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Wicks and Candles is written, hosted, and produced by Andreina Romero and Gabriela Mocken Romero. The image design is by Pamela Rowling. The podcast theme music is the Concerto for Two Violins in D Minor by Johann Sebastian Bach.